The ACN podcast is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners and sponsors, including the Agile Alliance. As a nonprofit membership organization, the Agile Alliance is an excellent resource to help you along your Agile journey. To learn more about the Agile Alliance and our other sponsors, as well as how you can become a sponsor or supporter of our show, please visit acnpodcast.org for more information. And thank you for your support. Good morning and good evening, everyone. This is Ray Arell. The Agile Coaching Network is brought to you by the Agile Alliance. If you're not familiar with this nonprofit organization, it started when the Agile Manifesto started way back when. They're actually the custodians of the manifesto and is sort of an independent voice within this whole big realm of this big word called Agile. Please go up and give them a look. The Agile Coaching Network, if you're not familiar with this, if this is your first time, this might be a slightly different format than you might be used to. This particular call, what we've learned is that there was a need or a demand for a forum that was more freeform, more like a park bench where people are sitting down and having meaningful discussions about whatever's top of mind. I'd like to kick off today's conversation with something that somebody was talking to me about earlier this month, and that was about the concepts of good enough. When is it possible to go ship something out the door? And I don't just mean code, I mean any type of product that we are currently working on today. And so if you think about when we call something good enough, from the customer's perspective, the customer looks at us as a, whether or not this is code or any other product, they don't know what's in the box. All they really see is the buttons and controls and whatever we choose to go throw out to put in front of the customer itself. Now, over time, as everyone has been in the industry long enough, if you look in the 90s, even the 80s or even earlier, we tended to push the complexity of our product off onto our users. So as an engineer, I would go create something that I thought was good enough for me, but for the user, they ended up having to eat the complexity by having to go learn this complex system that we actually threw at them. And back in the 90s and the 80s, this was considered to be good enough that, okay, if you want to learn how to go use this particular application or this particular product, you need to go take a class. And I remember that used to be complex courses that you would have to go through in college just to master something like doing a spreadsheet. If you look at today though, today the user, that complexity has now been pushed back into design. And designers and engineers are now managing that complexity. And if you look in especially in the web applications that we use today, you don't have to take a class to go and use them. They have an intuitive interface that when I approach them, that I can get something done or get something accomplished without having to go through a very long list of tutorials or even taking a class associated to that. What has emerged from that is that the user, even though now they're behind and only having to go look at this, you know, from the black box perspective, only sees the one user interface, the engineering and design is actually now having this behemoth of complexity and complications that might exist within their product itself. And if we talk about this just in a purely code sense, you know, this question of what is good enough, yes, it might work for the customer, but if you have a big ball of complexity, as you know, it might be the function works, but it might be too slow, or it might not be as responsive as we would like it to be, or there's other entities that are associated to it where it might diminish the value of the product that we see. And hopefully you've all hit this problem statement. I have multiple times in my career. Question of good enough, if you think of, you know, inspect, test, repair, refactor, and the back end of this flow is this maintainable thing. As an engineer, it now becomes my ability, if we scaled this up to a million users, that when a defect comes in, that since it's been refactored and cleaned and it's good, sort of from a clean code perspective or a clean product perspective, I am able to then go approach and probably maintain this very well. But as everyone knows, when we're in the DevOps situation or as we're doing our sprints or we're doing our demos, that question of, do we short circuit the steps that we have in order to claim it's good enough and then go and perform an early shipment itself? And so my kickoff questions for today and for to get us going into the discussion is, so what is good enough from your perspective? I'd like to hear what that is. And also within that, how do you set that level? What's the level that you would go and pick? How do you do that within your organization to say that that is the right level? It's okay to go ahead and do that shipment. And then lastly, how do you defend or push back on expectations that people might throw at you? Meaning that if you have, and I've had these big long discussions within a lot of release meetings of the person who would say, I want to go ahead and move forward with the shipment, and here's how I defend it. And then on the opposite side of that, if you're the person sitting there going, no, that doesn't look right, how do you push back on the expectations that people are saying that that's good enough? And so with that, Hendrik, do you want to kick this one off?
Yeah, I can try. So what is good enough towards the customer? For me, there's two perspectives, of course, in this. And one thing is the customer and the other one is your own company. And of course, for the customer, you try to deliver as good quality as possible. And usually what pushes against that is time and scope. So it's always a question, do we have enough time left to find out how well the system performs? Or have we maybe even found in our tests any problems where we are not proud if we are shipping this now to the customer? And in my experience, at least in our company, we have at some point in time, because too many things, when the pressure comes between delivering on time, delivering quality, then is there any penalties involved if we deliver too late? We sometimes have contracts like that. Then too often we had an unfavorable thing where we shipped something which did not live up to the quality standards that we wanted to see. So that led to that we created something which we called the stone tablets, which was a set of criteria that have to be fulfilled before we ship. So we actually put quite some governance around this. So that was the thing that we did towards the customer. There's another dimension to this, and that's the internal thing. Even if it's good enough for the customer, it might not be really good enough for us because we have a lot of technical debt in the product. So that is, of course, a whole different question. And one good practice I have found around that is when you need to log your technical debt as you would log a feature on a backlog of a product, and then you need to really plan this in before you ship the next product. So it, in that moment, it needs to become like a feature and it needs to be prioritized accordingly.
Your products, some of them are put into the ground, correct? There's like cell towers and other things.
That's another interesting thing, software versus hardware. I mean, software you can always fix later. Hardware, when you have a field change order later on, it hurts big time. So hardware, there the criteria, the quality criteria are much, much tougher than on the software side.
Thank you for the clarification on that. Linda, do you have something to add to this?
Like Henrik's approach there, I would say that fundamentally, planning out work in small pieces and getting acceptance as you go, I think really helps make sure that the customer's getting what they want. Of course, it helps to be talking to the real customer, not a middle person, whether that's a person inside your company or whatever. And to, while you can agree overall at the beginning to the main objectives that you want to achieve, or if you want to call that something like scope, that's good. But I find that it helps to show your work as work in progress and get the feedback from the customer sooner rather than later. The smaller you can make that feedback loop, the better chance you'll have of having a satisfied customer when the work is actually complete.
Shauna, how about you?
Yeah, I really like what Linda said. You know, if you can set up incremental demos with the customer, with your stakeholders along the way, and it becomes a collaborative conversation, it's by the time you're not just popping out of the box at the very end saying, look what we developed. What do you mean it's not what you want? So getting to good enough is much easier when you have that buy-in all along the way. And so what that looks like is really, as Linda said, those small incremental pieces, being able to say, for the first thing that we're just going to show you, it's just going to be pretty minimal, but let me just show you that it works. And I really want to get your feedback early. So early feedback, more customer engagements or sponsorship engagements is really the key, in my opinion.
Great. Thank you for that. And how about Jorg?
Maybe a bit thinking about the pushing back or making visible what the decision is about is always thinking in benefits. So I always try to phrase the discussion, especially if I'm the one wanting the product. So looking at the role more from a product manager or a salesperson's perspective, if people can tell me what pain I will suffer if I rush them on something, I'm very open for trade-offs. If they tell me this is a story you can tell to your customer and actually then you don't need X, Y, and that, it's a totally different discussion from X, Y, and that will be late. So always try to give something and explain what is already there, because very often this is eye-opening to the other side, be it a real customer you can talk to, or as I said, salespersons or product managers, because then they suddenly see opportunity. And very often they're quite good at thinking in opportunities. But if they block because they hear what is not possible, and if they hear technical debt in technical terms, they might be very much uninterested to know what the problem is. But if they know that future features cannot be rolled out as fast, instead of saying, yeah, you can get that and the next update will look like this and actually you can deploy it within 1 week, discussion changes. So always trying to frame it correctly. And yeah, sure, if it's big cell towers, some things must be in place very, very solidly. And there, follow the rules. As Hendrik said, the stone tablets are highly important, but not as a holy rule in terms of exactly this must be done, but exactly this end must be achieved and proven. If you find a new way to do it faster, more effective, or to even better quality, don't hinder people. Very often such rules are interpreted in the wrong way. Never do this. Take a challenge as how can we do it better, not as why are we doing it in that way.
Thank you for that. Sheila M., what do you have to add to this?
Well, I was thinking about in different industries, the answer can be very different. I've worked in the secondary mortgage market where I was working on payments to investors. There, good enough was it's perfect. Anything less would be raising the possibility, it would put the company's credibility in doubt. And it would potentially cause investigations because it was financial services. I've also worked in telecom on billing applications and on sales applications in a different telecom. And in both cases, good enough was like, it's about 80% right. And there were so many promotions and so many other variables that it was really pretty difficult, and they changed constantly. So it was really pretty difficult to get any more than an 80% right, because it's going to change tomorrow regardless of what we put in place today. And the other thing I've thought about with this is, it depends on who your customer is. When it's internal customers, sometimes you can use something that's kind of cobbled together and fix it in the next round, and then in the next increment. But if it's for someone like customer care, where you're trying to get their scripts right, or you're trying to get the automated interface that an end customer is using as good as possible, You want to set the bar higher there than you do on some other things, just because it's still the credibility of the company and the user experience for the end user that you're trying to retain as a customer.
So in both of those cases, you would be looking at, you know, this quality bar as something that you would be reflecting against your customer and leveling the customer expectations?
Yeah, I think you do. I think you try to see what is realistic given who the customer is you're looking at. I mean, I can remember one time where we were having a major problem at the end of month on sales campaigns, and engineering said, well, just spread the transactions out over the month. and I had to explain to them with a straight face, without getting upset, that sales campaigns run on a monthly basis, and everybody jumps to get everything done at the end of the month. So you can't just say, we're going to have a network that can handle the capacity if it's spread out over the month, because from a business perspective, that's not how the business operates. And the business is bringing in the sales that are paying for your engineering work. So if we don't bring in the sales because we're spreading the transactions out, then some of us aren't going to have jobs in a few months. You know, I had to put it that bluntly to them to get them to understand that, yeah, I understand it's going to take you a while to upgrade the network, and we can go back and talk to the users and explain that there's whatever the problem was, there've been a couple of different things, and we could look for whatever workarounds we could in the meantime, because it wasn't an instant solution and it wasn't just one thing that needed to be fixed. But when you're looking at those kinds of things, yeah, you've got to talk about that. The other thing is, if you've got something that's so slow and cumbersome that it's unusable, and the reason is because you've got technical debt, then you don't express it to a non-technical end user as technical debt. You say, well, we really need to make some changes to the system, that what's going to happen from your perspective isn't that anything else is going to change. It's just going to get faster. So that's going to make it easier for you to use, and it's going to free up some of your time. Mm-hmm. And that they can understand.
Yeah, I found that if I go to a party and I start talking about technical debt, people tend to not be around me. I don't know why, but thank you for your input on that. Let's see. Let's go over to Sheila E. Are you there?
Oh, yes, I am. And Ray, if I was with you at a party and you wanted to talk about technical debt, I'd be happy to.
Awesome.
So I look at what's good enough at two levels, because as Sheila M was saying, quality is, in my mind, a separate thing for measuring good enough. And your quality, for me, quality is really important. And for quality, you want to get at that better, that perfect, that excellent. You don't want to be at good. Good is not going to be good enough. But when it comes to good enough with what you're delivering as far as scope, I feel like that's just a matter of, is this added value? Is it added value? Is the user experience something that the user is going to be happy with? And it may not be perfect because you don't have all the input. And I agree with whomever it was that said, getting feedback as quickly as possible will help that. And you will go from, being better to being excellent when you do that initial, when you do that release. But from a standpoint of value, I don't think you need to be perfect on the get-go. But from quality, you really want to have that bar much higher.
Okay. Yeah, that I think that makes a lot of sense. I think it also, would you say that also from an industry perspective too, if you release a product into an industry that has relatively, say, everyone else is slow, and then suddenly you release a product that's fast, you now have a differentiator, correct?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. And that makes you in that better versus just good, and gives you the competitive edge in being better or excellent. At that point, you can even be best.
Wonderful. Thank you for your input on this. Here is Adam. Adam, are you there?
Hi, Ray. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
So for us, when we moved to open source with our driver a few years ago, we've been actually able to push this decision to the customers. And by that, I mean, for every patch we merge, it's available on GitHub. So if someone wants the bleeding edge latest driver, they can go off and pull the code, build it for themselves, because they might want to check out the new feature or check out a bug fix they've been waiting for. And then for their more regular cadence, we have a weekly binary release, which is actually stamped with a stamp of quality. Usually that's a recommendation for production readiness. Sometimes, we we trip over a bit, but that's not a problem because you can always go take last week's driver, which is almost as brand new. And then for the more discerning customers that want the full stack, they get regular but less often releases of the full stack that's tested against their specific requirements. So depending on how much risk the customer wants to take with a new product or a new iteration of the product, they have multiple avenues of picking up the driver. And this actually had proved out, at least once we had a situation where we got a bug report on a driver version that we were still running through automated testing because someone took the driver and ran it on his use case within, I think, an hour of it being available to build. So that was an interesting experience.
Help me understand one thing about these partial builds or the builds that you put out for people to make their choice. But don't you at least on those perform some form of regression testing, some form of quality check to those, or do you just rawly put them out after I changed my line of code? I don't know if it might have broke something else and I just throw it out.
So to be able to merge we check that the driver will build after the change or the change won't go in, and we actually do that on multiple tool chains to make sure that everyone will be able to build it. We also have to pass, I think it's several thousand ULTs right now. Some use cases might be too complex for unit tests, so that might fail. We also have to run certification tests that take, I would say, about 24 hours because of the specification requirements, and we test them on multiple platforms. So the full regression suite takes a little bit longer. So if you just take the driver immediately, it's available, build it in 10, 15 minutes and run it, you'll beat the automation system.
Okay. Thank you.
Use case.
Thank you for that clarification. But it does sound like at least that there is some level of quality check that's being done before just throwing it across, which I think is good. Let's see. Linda, are you there?
I'm here. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. It's Friday. Well,
it is. So from my perspective, it was hinted at from one of the other commenters, is I've run into a case where your engineer, your developer is afraid to put the pen down and say it's done or it's ready. I spent a lot of time in automotive. I did fuel and brake lines. So safety related, you have to make sure that they're right. But I had an engineer that I will swear to you could have spent his entire career finessing the routing of some brake lines for one particular vehicle and model year. And I kept asking him, are we ready to start tooling? Are we ready to start tooling? He says, no, I need to make some tweaks. And what his tweaks were, adjusting a bend within the tolerance of that bend point. So basically making minor changes that no one would notice that would never affect the functionality of the part. And finally, I had to say, pen down, done. It's ready to go. It is good enough.
Right.
So the takeaway from that is to understand what are the true needs. What do you need? What does your customer need? What are your true needs for the performance? And understand that and to say, okay, when you meet that, you're done. That is good enough.
It's interesting because you're kind of bringing in that operational envelope kind of concept that we used to work with semiconductors. And mm-hmm. we would have test engineers sometimes say, well, if this part is at this temperature and this voltage, this part's going to fail. And reality is both those temperatures and that voltage was way outside of the operating parameters that we even put in our specifications. So it's, you know, you can call it a defect, but is it? You know, it's kind of that question mark in there.
And that's where you come back and say, nope, that is well within the operating range, and it is good enough. But yet there's consumer electronics parts that they're trying to use in automotive, and they'll only work in kind of your regular ambient temperature ranges. And the minute you put them in a car with extreme cold, extreme heat, and they will not operate at all. So that's not good enough at all. So it depends on where you're applying it.
And so within your scope, how do you convey via this operational envelopes itself, how do you keep individuals in the future of saying that, you know, that's an interesting corner you found, but how do you frame it to that individual so that they don't feel like their work was diminished for what they were trying to do?
If it's kind of an already and well-established environment that you're working in, you can go back to the specs and some of the documentation to say, no, this is what we've actually seen. This is what we have to meet. We're comfortable that we're going to perform within the envelope we have to. Now, if it's something brand new and there's a lot of we don't knows, then you're just going to have to say, hey, for what our experience has been, let's go with this, understanding that what you just brought up may become a real issue, but we don't know enough yet. We don't have that question answered.
Okay, that's very good. Thank you for that. Keevan, are you there?
Hi, Ray. Yes, the comments made by several people before, you know, speak of collaboration, and that collaboration effort of getting something in front of the decision maker is really important. But the two things others have touched upon it is that the definition of done, whether that's back to acceptance criteria, working in software industry or even automotive, you have definition that you need to say done, because what happens in software is you have endless refactoring. You have people who want a gold plate and say, well, I'm not quite done with this. I'm not quite done. But if it's meeting the objectives, the criteria, it's time to, as people have said, put the pen down, put pencil down, move it on into testing and then that collaboration mold. That's what I've seen of good enough is the two things up front is that the definition of done with your development team and then the acceptance criteria that your product owner or eventual customer needs to say, this is what I'm looking for. These are the main components of how you define a product.
Fully agree with that. We are right now at the bottom of the hour and the question for the group, and with a show of hands, how many of you guys would like to pivot over to the questions that are over on Slido? And depending on the number of hands that are up, we will pivot or stay on this particular topic. Look at all those hands going up. So I'm going to go ahead and put all hands down. The top question up here, Shauna, this is yours. Got 62 votes. Shauna, do you want to take this one? Do you want to give us some contrast and some background to it?
Sure. As an Agile coach, oftentimes, whether it's people on the executive team, whether it's other folks within the organization, when you're going in and you're trying to make continuous improvements or help build high-performing teams, a lot of times I get the question, how do you know that you're successful? How do you know that you're reaching what you feel good looks like? And I oftentimes feel that it's a really hard question to answer. I know how I measure success, but I kind of just wanted to reach out to the group and see what all those Agile coaches out there, what do you guys do to really help the organization understand how you're making a difference?
Cool. Thank you. Linda, do you want to take a stab at this?
Sure. I'd love to. This is a great question, Shauna, and it's not always a black and white type of answer. So certainly when I start an engagement, I always try to understand what the customer's looking for and try to figure out how well can I do helping them achieve their goals that they want, whether it's to help a team improve their capacity or quality or learn some new practices, whatever. And so I try to measure to some degree some of my success along the way the customer would measure it. But I find that very often, generally what you get as a coach is you just get feedback every now and then. Hey, thanks, you were a great help here or there, or could you help out in this other case, whatever. So what I've done is kind of on a weekly basis, do just a little mini self-assessment and ask myself things like, how was I helpful this week? Is there anything that I did that made a measurable difference? And if so, kind of what was that? And then figure out if there are things from that point, decide what sorts of things should I do next week and what goals would I have for those actions, right? So if, let's say I want to make a recommendation about a particular team and things that they could do to improve. I never set an expectation that all my recommendations are going to be accepted. I usually send out several suggestions at one time with the hope that the client will find one of those favorable and that they're willing to try it and then sort of take it from there. Rarely a black and white answer.
Hendrik, do you have any input on this one?
Yeah, I had also a bit like Shauna, the experience that sometimes executives are asking for this. So how can you prove that you are doing a good job and so on? There is a confrontative way to encounter this, and that is you can ask back, okay, how do you know that you are doing a good job? Because there is a big difference between outcome and output. And very often the problem is that a team delivers also output, and output is measurable. You can see how many lines of code somebody has written or how many features have been shipped. But for leadership positions like managers or coaches, they are not writing any line of code and they are not delivering anything really. So these are roles where it's very much about outcome. So when the question comes, okay, how do you measure this? You're pretty much more looking into outcome, like customer satisfaction and so on. So that is maybe more the direction to look into. So essentially, my take on this is agile coaches are actually in a sort of leadership position in a company. And the assessment whether they are doing a good job or not should be similar to how you measure the performance of a leader.
See, I fully agree with that. I think, though, the challenge that we have with most leadership models, and I've done this with executives, my prior place of employment, as well as doing the work that I do today, I ask the question, how do you measure yourself? Because they always ask the question of how do you measure an agile coach? And I reflect that on them because those similar metrics are the metrics that the agile coach should be putting against themselves. Yeah. And that could be anything from, we have a problem with employee retention. Well, why do we have that retention problem? Because maybe
exactly.
We're... Go ahead.
Those are the kind of metrics you're looking then at. Yeah. So you look at employee satisfaction surveys. You're looking into team health checks. You're looking into, is the customer happy? Is the outcome from a product perspective good? Because in the end, an agile coach is for me someone who helps the team to be high performing and who helps the organization to be high performing. So the manifestation of that high performance is usually in the product, in the deliveries, but also in the happiness of the customer, the happiness and the satisfaction and so on of the teams and the people. So those are the kind of metrics I would be using, or actually I'm using actively.
Well, cool. Thank you for that. Sheila E.
I wanted to amend to all that or add on to that, because there is a difference depending on the organization that you're at, the maturity level of the teams, whether or not they're new to Agile or they've been doing it for a couple of years. So the way you're going to measure your success is going to be very different in different ways. There's no, as somebody said, it's not black and white. But I also agree that you need to have some metrics that you take early on. You need to do somewhat of an assessment of the organization and where they are and their maturity within the agile space. And then every periodically go through and re-measure that and see that you're actually making progress.
One thing that I just want to throw out, and Shauna, I don't know if this is part of what your question was. I believe that any form of measurement that we establish for one another is just a placeholder to say, are we making progress? Versus when I see someone say, measure agile coaches, I kind of feel that stacked ranking, what am I going to put on this person's performance review type of thing? We're not in that space, right?
Yeah, I think my question was more around, a lot of organizations, especially that may be new to the agile coaching model, are really trying to understand the value. And so as we're trying to maximize value, I think that understanding, a lot of what Hendrik put out there as far as customer satisfaction, as well as effectiveness within the teams, I think that how do you measure that and say, look, these are the things I'm observing, here's where I'm going to go in and make an impact. And then being able to see results on the other side to really maximize the value of the agile coaching team, I think is really important. And so in my mind, it's really around that.
Okay, Cool. Thank you for that clarification. Geoff?
Geoff, hi. Yes. Hi. Yeah, I just thought it's worth adding that what's measured is important in an organization, you know, what they look at in terms of metrics and outcomes is a massive indicator of what's important in the organization. So one of the things I look for is if I'm doing my job properly, then they're starting to talk about and measure and pay attention to the sorts of things that an agile coach should be paying attention to. Is the team learning? Is the team improving what they're doing? Looking at a lot of metrics around that, but the mere fact that you get those metrics up to attention and get them up in front of the executives as part of that conversation is a really good indicator of success as an agile coach. So yeah, it's changing the conversation. So changing the conversation to actually talk about agile and talk about the sorts of things that we're trying to improve as agile coaches.
So in other words, don't have like these two different metric packages of one metric package focused at the executive level that doesn't have any coherency to what's actually been going on below in the organization.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm very much of the view that Agile's culture, it's about, you know, beliefs and values and attitudes as much as it is about behaviours. So you need those things to be aligned, and the more they're aligned all the way through the organisation, the more agile the organisation's being, and in my head, the more successful I'm being as an agile coach.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. Bruce, are you there?
I was just thinking about, Ashana mentioned something about models, and Geoff just recently mentioned about learning. I come at this with the question, first of all, of what kind of performance are we wanting to measure as part of our success? And I come at coaching from an education background. So in education, the actual performance of the organization is the responsibility of the kind of the domain of organizational development. And it's much bigger than a single coach can actually obtain or attain. What a coach can do, though, I think, is to develop capabilities, let's say at a team level or enterprise level, you know, executive level, maybe whatever level that they're coaching at. But the capabilities are usually individual capabilities. So what the type of performance I'm thinking of when I coach is, you know, what are the individuals capable of doing that they weren't capable of doing before? That kind of falls short of maybe some expectations that might be, well, is that team actually performing better, or is the agile transformation occurring as expected? But I think those questions and those measurements are a little bit beyond the scope of a human being and a coach. It would require maybe a coach developing some center of excellence or something that was actually helping in the transformation. And then the success of the transformation or the success of the center of excellence could be measured. But the measure of the actual coach himself is whether individuals are improving their capability.
Okay. In that, because you mentioned education, and I know education has a number of frameworks of measuring. When you have a group of students, the students have zero knowledge associated to the particular topic that they're being coached or being taught in, to where they gain proficiencies. And from those models, have you seen any of those that directly come back into coaching in the wider industry?
Yes, I've actually seen, if you take an Agile Maturity Index, what I've done is I've applied that to a team prior to coaching and made an assessment of their capability at, you know, the beginning point. And for example, they may be at a level one capability already in Agile terms. They may have, you know, collaboration happening, and, you know, they're planning, and they're able to commit, and they're actually fulfilling their commitments, you know, basic level of what you'd expect from a Scrum team. But they're not really anything transferring upline from that to like the product owner and his ability to have a full backlog ready for, you know, every planning session and things like that. So you want to improve. So I've been able to say, for example, yeah, I made this team grow one level of, you know, in their agile maturity, although that's different than what I'm saying. I think one job I had was to just help some scrum masters to improve their capability to get the teams to collaborate. And so it wasn't really about, my measure of success wasn't that the teams were actually collaborating better, but that the individual scrum masters demonstrated the ability to, you know, move them along and right. Ask coaches themselves.
Well, thank you for that. One of the things that I found also is that, you know, the trickiness of the measurement is always because we're measuring that we're helping another individual move forward in something. And the question is, what was my role in it and what was their role in it? And I never try to go take credit for what another person did, but if that person can then evaluate me and tell me how I helped them, and that becoming a part of the measurement also works really, really well. Let's see, Maximilian.
Yes, hello. Greetings from Austin, Texas. Yes, this question in particular was one that I struggled for years. I mean, I would say a decade, but I always tried various approaches because I had to find a way to measure the impact, right? Because it has to be data driven. And then I found one approach that worked very well. And it was a simple fact of, as soon as I start having to work with a team as an agile coach or a corporation, I would give an anonymous survey based on the agile manifesto, the four principles, four questions. How efficient do you think your team is responding to change? How efficient do you think your team is in collaborating with stakeholders and customers? And based on a score out of 10, I would get an NPS score when we started. And whenever we're about done, whether it be, I have an estimate of 9 months to a year, it takes at least to have a good pulse check on the impact that has been occurred, give the same survey again. You will get data points. Yes, it could be skewed because the amount of people in the team are not the same, and there's some things you have to put into perspective, but you get a data point that is based on people's perception of what has happened. And that has been the most successful way I've seen in my experience.
Cool. Well, thank you for that. Randall, how about you?
Yes, the one thing I would just like to add is that, you know, I think this is a great question. Thanks, Shauna, for posing it. It's unfortunately, I think that the answer to this is kind of it depends, which is not a great answer. But I do like to, you know, not only do I like to try and go with leadership and, you know, and meet with them on a consistent basis, keep a good rapport going with them and good flow of information, but I always like to do the same thing with the scrum masters that I'm working with to make sure, am I meeting their needs and how can I help them? And I think that sometimes we get so focused on managing above us, we forget about the people that we're trying to work with. And to me, that's I get more value out of finding out from the scrum masters, am I meeting their needs and how I'm able to help them, than I get from people above me.
So are you saying that you're trying to go measure your value to your customers?
Yes.
How agile are you? That's pretty cool. You know, and incremental proofs of value added on top of that would be probably an interesting exercise to just break out a framework of what would be those incremental proofs of value as I walk through doing those things. Thank you for that, Randall. Ron, you get to take us home today because we're approaching the top of the hour. Ron, what do you have?
One simple thing that one of our coaches came up with was just a simple one question survey that he sends out at the end of an engagement, just kind of a net promoter score. You know, how likely is it you would recommend the services of our coaches to other associates? And that, while it's not exact, at least it gives you kind of a feedback, and they could leave comments as well in terms of, did they feel that what you did with working with them was effective or not, that they would feel positive or neutral or negative in terms of promoting us for other engagements.
Wonderful. I know that there's been criticism about NPS scores and how they work, but every single thing that I do in interactions or classes or tutorials or any of the work, I tend to go throw an NPS score out just because I know that that gives some really, really good feedback as far as a measurement system. So thank you for that. And we are right now at close to the top of the hour. So I just have a couple of announcements to make. If you guys haven't seen this yet, if you go up to agilealliance.org, Agile Coaching Network, you can see the URL up here on the screen. Or if you just go to agilecoachingnetwork.org, there's a vanity URL that'll take you to this page. We now have a Slack channel that's available because there's been a number of people who said that, you know, this gap of 1 month between when we have conversations, I'm having withdrawal. So there's now a Slack channel that's available. If you put your email address into there and hit the invite me, it would send you an invite to that Slack channel. Same rules that apply here apply there. So don't think that you can go in there and suddenly start selling stuff to people. That'll be a good way of getting, you know, someone wagging a finger at you really quick. But it is now available and there's conversations that have been going on there. So I would recommend going up there as soon as you can and getting signed up. We'd love to have you a part of that. If you go up to agilealliance.org and you go up to, if you look at the events, you will notice webcasts. So the next place that you'll hear my voice will be at a webcast that we're having next week. This is a part of the Supporting Agile Adoption Workgroup. I will be moderating this, and these two great people, both Yuta and John, will be giving a great presentation next week. I invite you to join that. It's a free webinar, so come on up and join that. We will do a 20-minute presentation followed by the rest of the time just in this type of open Q&A perspective. So we would love to have you. And so with that, I'd like you guys to have a great month. Hopefully you guys are all staying safe and finding your way to get some exercise and getting out. And just as we start to open back up the world, we could start to, you know, maybe one day soon, see each other face to face again. Everyone, take care.
This podcast is provided by Agile Alliance for educational and informative purposes only. To find out more information about the member-supported Agile Alliance, please go to agilealliance.org to find out about more upcoming events as well as different programs that are available to help you with your Agile journey.